From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Israel and the Palestinians. President Trump says it's time for peace. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. Even if Israel were pushing hard for a two-state solution, the Palestinians are still divided among themselves. On his way to the White House tomorrow, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas cut off power to Gaza, ruled by the militant group Hamas. Meantime, Hamas has announced a new charter, less hostile to Israel, but closer to the Authority than it's been before. Trump's first foreign visit since taking office may be to Israel and the territories. Will enough have changed that he can make a difference? Later on today's Talking Point, are White House assurances about replacing Obamacare premature? Again? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To the Point. President Trump says there's no reason there can't be peace between Israel and the Palestinians, but the first step will have to be unity between the West Bank and Gaza. Are the Palestinian Authority and Hamas any closer to speaking with one voice? Today's Talking Point, another health care defeat may be looming for the Republicans. Congress may not repeal and replace Obamacare this week after all. Protection for pre-existing conditions is front and center. First, this news update, a today of diplomacy for Russian President Vladimir Putin. He sat down in person with German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Sochi, and he talked by phone with U.S. President Donald Trump. What do we need to know? Here's Matthew Rojanski, who directs the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center in Washington. He's just back from Moscow. Always good to have you on our program.
Yeah, thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me.
The White House is pretty slow in getting out the talking points after the phone call. We don't know exactly what did take place, but based in your trip to Washington, to Moscow, what do you think Vladimir Putin wants and needs?
So what's interesting, my impression from the very latest conversations I've had with Russians is very different than even 2 months ago. So 2 months ago, I think Russians were guardedly optimistic. They had some concerns that the initial euphoria that you might have seen from the Russian parliament, the champagne popping and so forth, that Trump won the election. They were already beginning to back off of that, but they were still guardedly optimistic that, you know, Americans and Russians are going to get along, the relationship's going to improve, maybe there's going to be progress on sanctions. Now the message is pretty gloomy. I would even say complacent about the idea that this low place that the president has said U.S.-Russian relations are at a low point, that is basically going to stay for the foreseeable future. What's interesting is not just from the American side. Yes, there's definitely been a change in tone on the American side, being very tough on Russia, being very serious about these demands from Russia on Syria and Assad, but also on fulfilling their commitments in Ukraine. But it's also the Russian side. They're going into the next year of an election cycle, culminating with the re-election of Putin, almost guaranteed in March of 2018. But he has still got to, drum up public enthusiasm and support, and he's got to maintain the support of his base. Even if he falsifies the results, he has still got to turn people out and maintain this image of enthusiasm. And so risking anything on the U.S.-Russia relationship, risking any political capital or the appearance of surrendering even one inch to the Americans, who they have depicted as the enemy for so long, that is too risky in the run-up to an election.
Apparently, Putin had a hard time with Angela Merkel in Sochi. She lectured him about all the things that Russia is doing wrong. Does that sort of thing help him with his election? Is it good to be seen as somebody who's not getting along with the European part of the world?
Well, I wouldn't say it's necessarily good, but it is very consistent with the dance of Russian politics for domestic political purposes for the last decade. And that's basically, look, we are a world power. The West has to come and meet with us on equal terms. So here's Merkel coming to Putin in Sochi, which is sort of his winter White House, if you will, genuflecting by taking the meeting. But at the same time, clearly this is not a meeting of friends, and this is also not a meeting in which Putin is going to allow himself to be dictated to. So she can wag her finger, but then he can very easily demonstrate, that this is just water off a duck's back, and that all things in Russia are going to continue with or without the West's disapproval, and that's generally what he does following those kinds of meetings. So he likes to take the meetings. He likes to have the phone calls. He likes the interaction. He would love to be at the high table of international politics, but that doesn't mean that he's going to take one bit of guff off of Western leaders.
Back to the White House. Whatever the White House ultimately may say about the conversation on the phone between the two leaders, how important is it who's in the room?
Well, I mean, I think it's generally valuable to have as much of the U.S. government's sort of capacity represented for these interactions as possible. But ultimately, you have to go with the principles, intuition and experience and understanding of U.S. national interests. I mean, for better or for worse, and I think, cyclically over the last 25 years, it has not been a very good thing. The U.S.-Russia relationship has been very personalized. So you had very positive relations between Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin. I used to call it the Bill and Boris show. And then you had initially positive relations between Putin and George W. Bush, which then soured. And then you had initially positive relations between Obama and Medvedev, which gave way to a really bitter, probably historically negative relationship between Putin and Obama. And I think now we're just beginning to see what the shape of the Trump-Putin relationship will be. After all, the two of them have never even met face-to-face. And so I think when and if there is a first summit meeting, that, of course, will indicate what the direction of at least the personal relationship is going to be.
We're just out of time. What about a personal meeting, and is that likely anytime soon?
There is so much speculation swirling about this in the Russian press. It's something we talk about a little bit on our side, but the Russians, there's a report every other day that there's going to be a meeting in May. No, it's going to be in June. No, it's going to be in July. But honestly, at this point, we don't have anything that's absolutely confirmed. And if I had to guess, I would say from the American side, we'd probably want to wait until we knew what that agenda was and how each of the issues on that agenda is going to come out. Otherwise, it's not worth the president's time.
Matthew Rojanski, just back from Moscow. He's at the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you, Warren.
In a moment, Israel and the Palestinians. President Trump says it is time for peace. This is To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. President Trump took office with no experience in foreign affairs. Now he is addressing one of the world's most intractable land disputes of recent decades. Here's what he had to say in an interview with Reuters last week.
But I want to see peace with Israel and the Palestinians. There's no reason there's not peace between Israel and the Palestinians.
But the Palestinians are deeply divided between the Palestinian Authority, which governs the West Bank, and Hamas, the ruler in Gaza. Hamas is considered a terrorist group by the U.S. and many others, but yesterday it announced a new charter less hostile to Israel than it has been before. Nidal Mughrabi is a senior correspondent for Reuters in Gaza. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
What can you tell us about this new charter, which I gather was anticipated?
Yes, Hamas leaders, said they have been in preparation for this new political document, as they called it, for the last 4 years. As they say that this is like a natural process of development in the group's thinking after 3 decades of their foundation. The new document, as flexible as it sounds, is an attempt by Hamas to present itself as a potential political player with which the international community can engage with. And in the same time, it reflects, a frustration by the Hamas, group, on the side of the Hamas group, because it has been trying for years to join the PLO, but because of ongoing disputes between the PLO, which is led by President Mahmoud Abbas, and Hamas, there has all attempts at unity, at uniting the Palestinian ranks, have failed. These, attempts, continue to fail because both of the groups are holding up for what they believe. Hamas yesterday, and according to its chief, Khalid Mishal, is saying to the world that this is Hamas. This is the new political agenda of Hamas. It is a bit different from three decades ago when the charter had advocated the destruction of Israel and the removal of Israel. While Hamas is still keeping its rhetoric concerning the commitment to all of historical Palestine from the river to the sea, it has come to a closer terms with their rivals, President Mahmoud Abbas, in accepting a transitional Palestinian state in 1967. The only difference is that Hamas keeps its refusal to recognize Israel's right to exist on the rest of the land, while President Mahmoud Abbas and Fatah movement had accepted the two-state solution.
Nidal Mughrabi again with Reuters in Gaza. Diana Bhutu is a Palestinian lawyer and analyst. She served as legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team and to President Abbas from 2000 to 2005. I should remind our listeners that President Abbas is on his way to the White House. He's going to have a meeting with President Trump tomorrow. Diana Bhutu, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
How popular is President Abbas with his own people, the Palestinian Authority?
Look, this is a president who has had the lowest popular opinion polls of any other Palestinian leader or any other Palestinian politician. This is a man who 64% of Palestinians are saying not only that they dislike him, but that he should actively resign. And so these calls for him to resign have been growing. And as a result, this meeting with President Trump isn't going to do anything more other than try to attempt to get him to boost his own popularity, but really isn't going to do anything for him on the Palestinian street.
So what is the point, then, of meeting with President Trump? It's just to try to improve his position?
Well, here's a man who's only had one way of trying to address Israel's military occupation, and that's through having bilateral negotiations with Israel. Somebody who is part of these negotiations, I can tell you that they never work. They never will work. There's a structural problem with them. And instead of engaging in other methods such as supporting the growing boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, or supporting this growing movement of Palestinian hunger strikers, where there are 1,500 Palestinians who are currently on hunger strike, or instead of pushing for Israel's isolation, he instead continues to push for bilateral negotiations, a failed process. And so as a result, he has to meet with President Trump, and he has to continue try to push forward this one political agenda, and that is all that he's going to get out of it. If he ends up getting any sort of statement that there should be a resumption of negotiations, for him that will be a victory, but for the Palestinian people, all that negotiations have ever brought us is more and more settlements, more and more intensification of the occupation, and further away from our freedom.
Nidal Mughrabi, back to you. President of the Palestinian Authority, Mr. Abbas, who we just heard described as coming to the White House to try to improve his position with his own people, cut off the electrical power in Gaza. How long is that going to last? How difficult is it for people who live in Gaza? And what will that mean for any effort to get the two sides together?
Okay, the situation, in Gaza is very grim. So far, Israel hasn't responded to the authorities' demand to stop feeding Gaza with electricity line, which is 120, 5 megawatts, which is which we are depending on in Gaza right now for having between 4 to 6 hours a day of electricity, and the rest of the day is disruption of businesses, disruption of social lives. You have to reschedule social visits, family visits. Businesses are releasing workers because they cannot afford paying for them. They cannot afford paying for extra fuel to operate, their generators and to keep, the power up to take care of their businesses. Today there were rallies in Gaza Strip against the blockade, the ongoing blockade in Gaza. But these rallies have been turned by activists of Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and one of the PLO's groups, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, to condemn what they called as sanctions imposed by President Abbas on Gaza. And many of Hamas activists were screaming or crying on Abbas to leave. And some of Hamas leaders, came to the point of saying that Abu Mazen does not represent the Palestinians. The situation is that the authority-paid employees in Gaza, 60,000, employees are paid by the Palestinian Authority. They are suffering the loss of 30% of their salaries, actually. The markets in Gaza have been dependent on the salaries of those employees. So once you have those employees cashing their money from the banks, you will have the economy wheel going. You will see, the businesses will flourish and the markets will be crowded with people. Since the measure was taken early last month, the streets were almost deserted. Businesses and business owners were complaining of the lowest and the worst sale season ever in many years. Still, you will have some people who are trying to understand Abu Mazen's steps. Fatah people in Gaza Strip are trying to justify the steps taken by Abu Mazen, that he has been running out of patience. He's been frustrated by Hamas, who is not answering his call for unity, and that it was the only chance for him to try to squeeze them and pressure them to make concessions and to reconcile is through putting sanctions on Gaza that will make the economy situation in Gaza worse than it is at the moment.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we need to go forward. And I want to remind our listeners, Fatah is another word for the Palestinian organization. Abu Mazen is another word for another name, rather, for Mahmoud Abbas, who is, again, the leader of the Palestinian organization, although not supported by his own people. Let me turn to Aaron David Miller. He's vice president at the Woodrow Wilson Center, former Middle East negotiator under both Republican and Democratic administrations. His most recent book, The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Always good to talk to you.
Always a pleasure to be on the show, Warren.
When we hear what we do, that Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, has caused such extraordinary disruption in Gaza, how important is that to getting the Palestinian organization together, and how important is it that they join together to make effective the negotiations with Israel?
Well, on paper, I suppose you could make the case that a monopoly over the forces of violence within any society is the key to responsible statehood. I mean, a state that doesn't have the capacity to control all the guns and make them silent, at least in an organized fashion. I'm not talking about look at America, for example, and the proliferation of murders and weapons here. But I think it's very important on paper. The problem is, Warren, that I don't think that the prospects of unity between these two groups is a real possibility. And I think these circumstances are going to even make it more difficult. Look, the Palestinian National Movement is in crisis. My sense of what Diana says is probably right, that negotiations with the Israelis right now are pointless. In fact, I would argue that it would be foolish and counterproductive to try to return to them in under the current format. But the Palestinian National Movement, literally, it's like a modern-day Noah's Ark. There are two of everything, two statelets, two sets of security services, two sets of patrons, two charters, two visions of what Palestine is supposed to be and where it's supposed to be. And I think the notion that somehow you can have anything more than faux unity is probably very unrealistic.
How do you read, then, the invitation from President Trump to Mahmoud Abbas to come and visit Washington at this time?
I mean, how many times have you and I had the conversation about what to do about the never-ending story of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? The fact is the emperor, in this case the peace process, has no clothes. It, in many respects, is a fiction. If I were Mr. Abbas right now, though, because I'm not sure what other choice he has, I would play along, frankly, at the moment with Mr. Trump. How serious Mr. Trump is, what he envisions, bringing the Arab states in, outside in. It's hard for me to imagine any of this will work. If Mr. Netanyahu is indicted, however, and you get a fundamental transition or change, for Mr. Abbas, it would be better to be on the quote-unquote cooperative side of the equation as matters play out. Remember, this is 100 days into an administration that could conceivably last for 8 years, and Mr. Abbas is likely to not see another American president. This could be his last role, and while I don't think he's desperate for a deal or determined to make one, it's probably smarter because he actually has no other options than to listen to what Mr. Trump has to say and play the game.
Let me go back to Diana Bhutu. You've indicated, as did Aaron David Miller, that there's not much point in trying to restart the negotiations between the Palestinians and Israel. But is Mr. Abbas then doing the best he can to play along, to act as if President Trump might have an opportunity to help the process along? Is that sort of the best he can do?
Absolutely not. And that's the problem, is that when you view it as that's the best that he can do, then that becomes a logical conclusion. But for Palestinians, that's not what they're looking for. They're not looking for yet another 8 years of sitting by idly and waiting for more negotiations as Israel continues to build and expand Israeli settlements. And this has been 100 days under this Trump presidency in which we've seen the fastest rate of Israeli settlement activity since 1967. So the rate of settlement expansion is incredible. President Trump himself has indicated that he's not going to stop any of it. He's been the first president to be talking very actively about moving the embassy to Jerusalem. He's supported by the likes of Sheldon Adelson, who himself has never indicated that he believes in any form of equality for Palestinians. So this is not a president who is going to do anything for Palestinians. And so the wrong strategy is to just continue to play along the game. Instead, what Mahmoud Abbas should be doing is first and foremost signing on to the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. He should be pushing for Israel's isolation from FIFA, from other international organizations, and he should be actively supporting the popular resistance that's taking place on the ground. This is the only way that he can demonstrate that he's a leader to us, the Palestinians, who are the people who matter. But instead, to just play this game of somehow hoping that the stars are going to align and President Trump is going to come to his senses is a fool's errand.
Okay.
And we've seen this both before.
Diana Bhutu, once again, a Palestinian lawyer and analyst, a former legal advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team and to President Abbas, but that was back in 2005. We're going to take a very brief break. Later on our talking point, our White House assurances about replacing Obamacare premature once again. We'll continue this conversation after, once again, we take a very brief break. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Ollenbeck with To The Point. We're doing something unusual today on our program to sort of update what's going on between Israel and the Palestinians, not focusing on that relationship itself, but rather on what's happening amongst the Palestinians, who are a very divided people, as we have already heard. So that's why we don't at the moment, or haven't yet, and won't have a voice from the Israelis. We're not really talking about that relationship yet because it's so far away, apparently, from any kind of possible negotiation. I didn't say that very articulately, but I hope it's understandable. Youssef Munayyer is executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. That's a coalition of pro-Palestinian organizations working to change American policy toward Israel and the Palestinians. Good to have you back on our program, and thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
I think you're more optimistic than our other guests have been about the visit tomorrow of Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, with President Trump.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily describe it as optimistic or describe much in the region as optimistic. But what I would say is that I do think that there is a possibility, and I think this may be something that Aaron was getting at, that, you know, should this process continue, we might end up seeing a situation where the relationship between President Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu is not all as rosy as we initially thought it would be. You know, Benjamin Netanyahu is the kind of leader who simply does not want a deal. He wants a process without peace, to play this out as long as possible. And what he's demonstrated time after time is that he's always willing to say he'll engage in the process and at the same time provide some new hoop for the Palestinians to jump through before anything can move forward. We've heard before about the need to accept Israel as a Jewish state, which is an invention of Netanyahu's that did not exist in the earlier rounds of negotiations. Then this claiming of the incitement issue during the Obama years, and now once again we're hearing about demands that the Palestinians cease supporting the families of Palestinians who've been imprisoned or killed. And I think there's a chance that President Trump may realize that Netanyahu is the worst kind of deal maker that any business-minded person would ever want to encounter, which is simply somebody who wants to waste their time. That being said, I don't think that's necessarily going to lead to anything good for the Palestinians, and I think that Diana is exactly right. Abbas could engage in this and play along for a period of time, but the best that he's going to end up with this situation as is the status quo, which is this continued occupation, this continued denial of Palestinian rights, which is an outcome that Netanyahu is perfectly happy to accept. He would love it if a peace process could continue providing this cover for Israel's continued denial of Palestinian rights, but he'll be happy to take the status quo even without that if that's what it comes to. So the real question for Abbas, who's in a very difficult situation because he's invested so heavily in the notion of a Washington-led peace process, and because he relies so heavily on Washington to help supplement his budget, to pay for the folks around him with guns that are keeping him in power despite the incredible lack of legitimacy he has with his own people, he's stuck between that and the reality that going down that path leads to no results for the Palestinian people he's supposed to represent.
So what about the deal that, not the deal, but the change in the Hamas charter announced with such fanfare this week? How important do you think that is?
Well, look, I think that if anybody was looking at this announcement the other day by Hamas and expecting for Hamas to suddenly turn into a pro-Israel or Zionist organization, they were going to be disappointed. That was not going to happen. But we did see a real shift in the language from what had existed in their charter 30 years ago to something that is far more in line with what I would consider a Palestinian consensus on the political outlines of a solution today. And while they state very clearly that they still lay claim to the entirety of the territory, they recognize that there is a national consensus around the idea of a Palestinian state on the 67 borders with a capital in Jerusalem and a right of return for refugees. That is essentially a outline for peace that is in line with international law. So, you know, this puts them on par in many ways with many of the parties in the Israeli government, all of which currently do not support a Palestinian state, but nonetheless state that the policy of the government is to support two states for two peoples, therefore satisfying the so-called quartet principles. So if one wants to look at this and say there is an opportunity to bring Hamas into the conversation, and I'm sure it would be European states that would take that step before the United States, I think this provides an opportunity to do that, and it may provide an opportunity down the line for Mahmoud Abbas, who's really running out of options, to seek a renewed legitimacy among Palestinians by trying to advance national reconciliation. That will come at a cost, however, and it's not clear that that's a cost he's prepared to pay.
Let me go back to Aaron David Miller. You have been through a lot of this history with both Republican and Democratic administrations. Mr. Trump has talked about drawing on the Arab Peace Initiative, other countries surrounding Israel and the Palestinian territories. Is there some merit to that? And is there a possibility, coming as he does to this situation without any background at all, that Mr. Trump could find a new and different way to go?
You know, I've long abandoned the idea, and I'm sure Yusuf and Diana would agree with part of this, that the United States can essentially function as an effective, honest broker. I've always believed it can be an effective broker, and there's a difference between the two. But only if the parties themselves had the ownership and the leadership in order to bring matters to a point where, in fact, an outside party, a third party, if you will, despite all of the absence of American credibility and the like, could bridge the gaps. And that is why every breakthrough, with almost no exceptions, and there haven't been many, always occurred between the parties themselves. Dayan Tuhami paved the way for Sadat's trip. Oslo, failed process, to be sure. But it still was a heroic effort. Israeli-Jordanian negotiations were done in secret. Only then, once you had a degree of ownership by the parties themselves, could the United States play a role. We are not capable, frankly, of a redemptive role in this process. We are not capable of solving it. We are not capable of saving the Israelis and the Palestinians. And Diane may be right. I mean, the Palestinians, and Yusuf too, Palestinians may need to save themselves. I mean, national liberation movements either take what they want by force, negotiate for it, or wait a long period of time until somehow circumstances change, or as Diana suggests, and I think that's frankly a prescription for a galaxy far, far away rather than back here on planet Earth, that somehow BDS is going to deliver a statehood to the Palestinians. But I this is why I worry about Mr. Trump. Somehow he believes that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict really is a real estate deal. And part of it is a real estate deal. But it's so much more than that. And it requires a skill set and an alignment of the sun, the moon, and the stars, frankly, which for many reasons, Yusuf and Diana know them better than I, and I'm not prescribing or telling the Palestinians what to do. I've long gotten over that. In the end, this is ultimately going to be resolved as a consequence of pain and gain. There's a proximity problem between Israelis and Palestinians. It will not go away. And if it is not addressed, it is going to lead, I suspect, over time to a set of circumstances that may, in fact, create new realities on the ground. And I'm sorry that is the case. Perhaps the U.S. has abandoned some of its responsibilities in this regard, but I don't see much happening, frankly, as a consequence of this visit.
or in the months ahead.
Very quickly, Diana Bhutu also mentioned the expansion of settlements since the Trump administration began, the support of Sheldon Adelson, very, very much a supporter of the settlements, and the appointment of an ambassador to Israel who is very much like Sheldon Adelson. Does that suggest, Aaron David Miller, that Mr. Trump is not necessarily moving in the right direction if he wants to get the Palestinians together with Israelis?
I mean, you know, the question is not what religion you are. The question is not what set of experiences you have. We're all biased. There's no gold standard on this process. Yusuf, Diana, and I, we're all biased as a consequence of our experiences. The question is, can you set those biases aside and ultimately understand what is required based on the narrative and needs of each side to cut a deal? That's what is required. And then, if you're a mediator, the U.S., do you have the courage to apply both the honey and the vinegar, which is going to be required to push the Israelis and the Palestinians beyond their comfort zones? That's the question. And I've been wrong about everything relating to the emergence and rise of Donald Trump, and I'm hesitant to offer a guess as to what the fate of his Arab-Israeli peace initiative is going to be.
Yusuf Munayyer, back to you with the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. What do you say to that, and particularly the appointment of David Friedman? We haven't, as ambassador, we haven't talked at all about Israel. As I indicated at the outset, we're trying to look very closely at what the Palestinians are doing here. But Aaron David Miller also mentioned that Mr. Netanyahu might be indicted. How would that change things? Would that give the Palestinians, do you think, some sort of new opportunity if Israel had a weakness of leadership?
Well, I do think there are some unknown variables there that certainly could impact things on the Israeli domestic political scene. But look, if you look at Israeli politics, you have to understand that the entire polity has shifted very hard to the right. There has been a lasting legacy that the right wing has put into place throughout many institutions in Israeli society, and even if Netanyahu was to somehow disappear from the scene, if you were going to throw the cards up again, you're going to end up with a largely right-wing coalition. Even the so-called opposition parties are not in opposition to many of the security policies and the policies which continue to deny Palestinian rights that have characterized the right wing for very long. But I want to push back on this notion that Aaron presented about sort of the United States not being able to take the lead because the situation among the parties is not where it needs to be. You know, we can't pretend that we're not involved in this right now and all the time. We are very much creating the incentives for the Israelis in particular not to behave in the way that they should. We continue to finance the Israeli military industries and send over billions of dollars in aid, even as Israel continues to violate international law through the continued expansion of settlements, and even, against the stated policy of the United States for successive administrations. So we are creating the incentives through our policies, American policies, that are making it less likely that Israel would want to make peace. This idea that the status quo is unsustainable is simply not true. The Israelis believe it's very sustainable, in large part because the messages that they keep getting from Washington in big, fat, multi-billion dollar checks is that there's nothing really wrong with what they're doing. And I think as long as that continues to be the case, we're not going to see a change in Israeli behavior. So if honey and vinegar are going to be applied, it's long past time to start seeing some vinegar from the United States. And unfortunately, that's never really happened.
Very quickly, Diana Bhutu, I assume you agree with what we just heard, but I want to ask you before we run out of time about the BDS, as Aaron David Miller described it. That's the boycott and disinvestment movement. How widespread is it, and how widespread is it likely to be, and why do you think it would really be able to have an effect? Mr. Miller suggested that it would be that would happen on another planet.
Yeah, Yeah, and that's probably exactly what a person who was supporting South African apartheid would have said in 1980, just a decade before South Africa.
So quickly, just tell our listeners what it is and how widespread it is at the moment.
Absolutely. So the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement is a movement that is started by Palestinian civil society, by the grassroots movement, to push for the boycott of Israel, divesting from Israel, and placing sanctions on Israel until it abides by international law. It was a movement that was started in July of 2005, has taken off, and there are countries around the world and companies around the world that have actually heeded the call and are beginning to boycott Israel, divest from Israel. We're not quite there when it comes to sanctions. If there was a Palestinian leader that was pushing for sanctions, I think we would see a very, very different reality. And I think that just in the same way that it worked for South African apartheid to end apartheid in South Africa, I also believe that the same will happen to end Israel's apartheid.
Aaron David Miller, very quickly, as we heard earlier, the United States does a lot to support the military in Israel. Why did you say that the BDS has virtually no chance of success?
Well, you know, first of all, before we jump off the cliff quicker, I only remind Diana that the South African situation had another ingredient, which I know she's aware of, and that is two individuals who were determined to divide history, their own constituencies, and to create the kind of pathway that enabled, literally, South Africa, with all of its imperfections, to defy history. Nobody believed that apartheid would end without blood and more blood, and yet it did, largely driven by Mandela and de Klerk. So we can talk about international and external pressure, fine, but you need leaders who are not prisoners of their ideologies and their politics, but masters of their constituencies. And I'm sorry, we don't have them.
Okay.
We don't have them in Israel, and we don't have them in the putative state of Palestine.
All right. Once again, this is all the time that we have. It's been a very interesting conversation from a different standpoint than we have generally heard it before, and I'm very happy that we were able to do it with all of you. Aaron David Miller at the Wilson Center, thanks to you. Thanks to Diana Boutu, a Palestinian lawyer and analyst, a formerly legal advisor to President Abbas, whom she no longer seems to support, Youssef Munayer at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and our earlier guest, Nidal Mughrabi, the senior correspondent for Reuters in Gaza. Good to have all of you on our program. The Trump White House may have overpromised again on replacing Obamacare. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Warren, on back with today's talking point. With Congress scheduled for another recess on Thursday, House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy said this today about repealing and replacing Obamacare. Now is not the time to decide what to do or how to do it. Now is the time to do it. But despite this weekend's promises by the Trump White House, that may be too little too late. Dan Diamond is healthcare reporter for Politico and creator of the podcast Pulse Check. Great to have you with us.
Great to be back, Warren. Thank
you. Tell us about Fred Upton.
Oh, geez. So Fred Upton, the longtime House representative from Michigan who ran the Energy and Commerce Committee, stepped down because of term limits this year, has said he will not vote for the Republican plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And that is striking for a few reasons. First, this is a guy who was a pivotal leader in the House for years, voting and coming up with plans to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And now he says this amendment, the version of the bill right now, goes too far. I think, secondly, if you are Paul Ryan and you are looking across the caucus, if you are losing guys like Fred Upton, there's another gentleman, Billy Long, who has said he can't vote for this bill, these are the dyed-in-the-wool folks that you normally count on. And if they are having second thoughts, that bodes poorly for the dozens of people who have yet to weigh in.
Billy Long of Missouri. His daughter had cancer. He said he wouldn't support it because of the pre-existing condition. Here's an interesting comment from an arch-conservative Republican sounding unsympathetic to the idea of pre-existing conditions. Mo Brooks of Alabama.
My understanding is that it will allow insurance companies to require people who have higher health care costs to contribute more to the insurance pool that helps offset all these costs, thereby reducing the cost to those people who lead good lives, they're healthy, they've done the things to keep their bodies healthy. And right now, those are the people who've done things the right way that are seeing their costs skyrocketing.
So, Dan Diamond, how do you interpret that kind of comment coming from Mo Brooks?
Well, I think, Warren, there's a little bit of truth in that people who have pre-existing conditions and illnesses, they are sicker. They need more health care and they're more expensive. And right now, the Affordable Care Act depresses the ability to discriminate based on price, which if you are a young, healthy person, maybe that's a bad thing. If you are a sicker person, that's obviously a good thing because you're not having to spend as much. I think the broader point, though, he is totally wrong in that Brooks seems to be arguing that if you live a healthy life and you do the right things, you don't get sick. And I think you, me, your listeners know, illness can strike at any time. An accident can come along as I'm crossing the street. So it seems foolish and hard-hearted to say that folks who are sick could have controlled for that when in reality it's about genes and environment and luck.
And, of course, there is pressure in the other direction of a very powerful sort, not just from the AMA and other doctors, but also from celebrities. Here's TV host Jimmy Kimmel last night after revealing that his newborn son had surgery for a heart murmur.
Before 2014, if you were born with congenital heart disease like my son was, there was a good chance you'd never be able to get health insurance because you had a pre-existing condition. You were born with a pre-existing condition. If your parents didn't have medical insurance, you might not live long enough to even get denied because of a pre-existing condition. If your baby is going to die, and it doesn't have to, it shouldn't matter how much money you make. I think that's something that, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or something else, we all agree on that, right? I mean, we do.
So, Dan Diamond, there is Jimmy Kimmel choking up a bit. He, of course, could afford to take care of his son, but very sympathetic to people who can't.
Well, that Jimmy Kimmel video, Warren, I posted it on my own Twitter feed fairly quickly last night. I can tell you, I looked at it right before I got on the phone with you. There are more than 500,000 views on my little tweet, my snippet alone, which tells me that if 500,000 people saw my one tweet, there are tens of millions of people, if not more, who have seen this Kimmel video that's rocketing around the web. And here in D.C., I've been asking congressional staffers, especially Republicans, are you hearing from folks who have seen this Kimmel video? Are you talking about it? And they're acknowledging, yes, this has led to a groundswell. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel, who would have thought? But this Jimmy Kimmel video is giving voice to a lot of people who feel frustrated about the health reform effort and say this is why we don't want the Republican plan to move forward.
So tell us about the timing of all of this. The Republicans are trying to push this bill before they take another recess. The Trump White House was saying over the weekend that they've got it, that's going to happen. Everything is going to be fine, and they're going to finally repeal and replace Obamacare. It doesn't appear that's going to happen.
No, it does not appear as we talk at middle of the day on Tuesday that Republicans will be able to deliver on this week. Over the weekend, the White House was exceedingly optimistic. They were telling reporters, they went on TV and said, we think we've got the votes for this. That was not the case. They do not have the votes. They are, I believe right now, about 20 Republicans in Congress have said definitely no. Republicans can only afford to lose 22, and there are dozens of others who are either leaning no or undecided, so they are operating with the thinnest of margins and are talking now about yet again opening up the bill, drawing up new provisions, trying to make it a little bit more palatable. The only challenge is if you do that, maybe you win some folks over who are on the fence, you lose some of the folks who are committed. Republicans are supposed to leave town on Thursday for a congressional recess. They had wanted to do this vote before they left. There's the possibility of going back to their hometowns and getting deluged with town halls and losing momentum yet again. That's one of the things that they are worried about. Thursday morning, we are waiting, Warren, for the conference, the GOP representatives to all get together, and they're going to hash out their next steps, whether to hold a last-minute vote, to extend Congress and not go in recess, or maybe even say, you know what, we have to punt on health care because we haven't been able to do it.
And there's an important timing issue, too, because of the rules of the Congress. If they are to pass it and send it to the Senate this week, then they can get a Senate vote without any possibility of a filibuster, which the Democrats could probably put together with dissenting Republicans. So that's another source of pressure.
That's right. They do have a little bit more flexibility. It's this issue of budget reconciliation. It's this arcane tool. Democrats used it to help pass the Affordable Care Act 7 years ago. Republicans are hoping to use it because it allows them to avoid the filibuster. But if they want to accomplish their other legislative priorities, based on the way that they've teed up their agenda, they need to do health care first. So they'll be able to use the budget reconciliation tool. And if they don't do health care, then that opens up a slew of questions about what's next on their policy agenda. They were hoping to use health care to help set up the savings that they were going to use for tax reform and so on and so on. So there is some pressure there, a little unclear over how much, because they might be able to extend even past this week and still use the budget reconciliation tool.
Okay, so they might be able to do that if they stick around. They don't have a reputation for doing that very often unless the pressure is really huge. How much is Donald Trump helping when he says about the budget that they have come to agree on that only carries the government through September, that what the country probably needs is a good shutdown?
I mean, I think your question, how much is Donald Trump helping, is probably best met with a laugh when it comes to either the budget or health care. Forgive me for maybe speaking intemperately, but he has been a thorn in the side of Congress these past couple of weeks because he will say things that don't necessarily line up with their agenda or what they're working on with health care. Earlier this week, he said that the pre-existing conditions coverage in the bill wasn't good enough and needed to be as good as the Affordable Care Act. That was a major thorn in the side of Republicans. To start talking about the shutdown right now is not necessarily the issue that they want to be grappling with. They're still figuring out what to do on health care right now, let alone what's happening in 4 months with the government operating.
All right. I don't think that was intemperate so much as it was realistic and assessment of what's going on now on Capitol Hill and what's liable to go on in the ensuing dispute about these issues. Dan Diamond, it's great to have you as always.
I enjoyed it, Warren. Good to talk to you.
Healthcare reporter for Politico, creator of Pulse Check, a podcast on health policy and politics. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio National.